John Ogden, welcome to The Last Post. And we're here, for those listening and reading, to talk with John Ogden, who has produced this beautiful book, Waterproof, which is a collection of the work of some of Australia's great surfing photography. And a foreword from Tom Carroll too, John. It really is an amazing book, you know, covering Australian surfing, I think, since 1858, the photography.
Yeah, that's right. That actually, the subtitle came in Australian Surf Photography since 1858. It's a bit provocative because some people think of surf photography as just being the era of stand-up boards or even the era of professional surfing. But I took a pretty wide lens, so it was going to be about, you know, anyone who's attempted and succeeded in photographing the surf zone, so where ocean swirls become surf, where they come in contact with the coastline. And about a month before publishing, the earliest photograph I could find was in the 1880s, a shot at Coogee. And then I found this one from the State Library of Victoria, 1858, which just gobsmacked me because it's quite a beautiful picture. It's from Jan Juck looking across Bird Rock towards the Winky Pop Headland and Bills Beach just around the corner. And so 1858, Melbourne was only founded in 1835. The first photograph ever taken in Australia was 1841, so we're talking pretty early. Mm-hmm. It would have been just a goat track down to Jan Juck those days. And these big glass plate cameras where you needed, you know, you'd basically take the cap off the lens and hold a 1, 2, 3 count to probably 30 seconds and put the cap back on. So all the waves just look like mist because it's got a time exposure. So, but it's a gorgeous photograph. So that's where the subtitle came from.
Yeah. Thanks for going through that too. I was wondering about that myself and I was going to talk to you about that too. But I think with surfing photography, your collection of beautiful photos here, Australian surfing photography, what makes a good surf photographer? John, is there a subculture or is there a type of person? I guess they're united by the love of the ocean, but is there a particular person or a type that is attracted or good at surf photography?
That's a good question. I mean, there's two parts to the question. You know, what makes a good surf photograph for one, and the other one is what makes a good surf photographer. There's no hard and fast rule. One thing that they probably united on, they're all pretty quirky. They're all pretty quirky characters. Some, you know, are quirky to the extent of having schizophrenia, and that sort of creative genius may come out of that, but some are quite conservative in their own ways, and there's another group that were surfers who got injured, and in their injury time they took up surf photography and sometimes didn't go back to surfing, or they became just part of what they were doing. They became surf photographers, and that was the case of Tom Carroll, and why he was ideally poised to write the foreword. He was obviously a champion, 2 times world champion, but he was injured at one stage and started taking photos. And he was always been intrigued by light and how it worked on the waves. Mm. So he's wrote quite an eloquent foreword. But he not only had, you know, been a photographer, but he's had to deal with a variety of photographers, some good and some not so good, who got in the way during contests and that sort of thing. So he's sort of covered all gamuts of it, really.
Yeah, I have heard some stories about Tom, and that's interesting that he's provided that brilliant foreword and an example too of how close the surfing community is to the photographers that take those photos. What's your relationship with the ocean, John? And I suppose that leads into what made you want to produce this book. So firstly, I guess, what's your relationship? How did that start with the ocean?
I grew up in South Australia in the calmer waters of St. Vincent Gulf, so in the suburbs of Adelaide called Brighton. So the only time we really got waves was during storms. So we were the storm riders, and they were never that great a wave. And that's where it sort of started. When I was probably in the late 50s, my dad made one of what's called a toothpick, you know, the 18-foot hollow ply wood boards where people just made them in the garage. He was a carpenter after the war for a short time and quite skilled with his hands. And that was a beast of a board, 18-foot long, and me and my, you know, 8-year-old mate used to have to build a little trolley out of bike wheels and sort of to get it down to the beach. And you have to empty the water out of it at the end of the day. But then, you know, like my parents didn't really want to encourage surfing because the surfers were seen as kind of rat bags in those days, probably for a good cause. And they were a fairly conservative Catholic family I came from. But gradually I wore them down, you know, there was never a lot of money around. It wasn't a rich family. It took me ages to get money for surfboards and things. But it's a bit like an addiction. Once you have those highs from surfing, you never want to, you probably spend the rest of your life trying to recapture them. You know what I mean?
Yes, indeed. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. So Adelaide, with Adelaide, we lived in Brighton for a while too, my family, in Sturt Road, I think it was. We used to go down to Brighton and jump off the jetty before school during summer. And of course, I've lived there too as an adult, and I know that I have seen some surf there during storms. Did you get as far down south as the mid-south coast?
Yeah, well, that was the mecca for those days. It's like to get to the mid-south coast, and if you could, to the south coast. You know, to go down to
Middleton.
That was gold if you could do it. And you know, I still have really fond memories of really good days at those places, but because of the placement of, you know, Kangaroo Island, as you know, is virtually blocking entrance to St. Vincent's Gulf, you had to just depend on swells that managed to sneak around the corner between the island and
it's
the headland. Sort of limited the amount of times you had good swell. So I guess I always, you know, where I live now in Avalon, that used to always feature in magazines in the 60s, and I always thought, well, I'd love to go there, and finally I did move up here.
Isn't that interesting? It's a similar journey from mine. I remember reading Tracks and Surfing World in the early 70s, and then still living in Adelaide, left Adelaide in 73. But, yeah, it became a romanticised the East Coast, and just being given the opportunity to surf some of those spots, John, it was almost like stepping onto the set of a movie or something, because it was culturally significant.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I've just finished, I've been working almost the same time as doing Waterproof, I'd started doing the editing, structural editing on a book by Stephen Cooney. And it's just about to come out, should arrive in Australia in the middle of December, but in time for the 50th anniversary of Mourning the Earth in February, which is a pivotal, seminal kind of film in surfing. I think it's still in the 100 best films by the Film and Sound Archive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Stephen was telling his story, how his family got to Collaroy and how his mum went, saw the headmaster and said, my son doesn't want to go to school anymore, although it was illegal to leave school early. And I thought, gee, I wish my mum had done that. But he was there when Collaroy became the centre of the surfing universe for a second, and Nat Young won the world title in 67, and they were doing all the shortboard experiments out, you know, test driving boards out at Long Reef. So he was there, and I thought, oh, that's a brilliant kind of, you know, kind of really envious of him. But, yeah, I was getting all that via magazines. And when I left school, the first thing I did was move up the East Coast and stayed at Angowrie for a while and went to the other sacred places of surfing along the East Coast. And, you know, that was it. I was done. I don't think, you know, South Australia was definitely second place after that. I didn't leave it entirely. After I got called up for national service, which it was the last call up, and I didn't go to the call up, but I around that time I started working as a tuna fisherman over at Streaky Bay days when you polled tuna. And on the off season, after I'd made some money, it's a bit like summer, the $17, you go and blow all your money. So I used to go up to Asia or wherever. But one winter, we spent the whole winter at Cactus, just built little huts and lived in the sand dunes there. I think it's like in the winter of 73 or 74.
Yeah, yeah.
And contributed towards that book, Cactus. I don't know if you ever saw it, but we just republished it under Cyclops Press recently. It's a really nice book. John Wixie called it arguably the best book on surfing ever published in Australia. So that
actually, I have heard someone said the same thing. I think Murray Walding, a friend of mine, had said something about that book. Someone I know had said that it was a real book to read and to appreciate. I remember Streaky Bay. My brother and I went there to visit a friend who'd moved from Adelaide in the winter of 73. So we weren't that far apart at that stage. It's an incredible area. Incredible area. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So when Where did surfing come from, John, and when did it arrive in Australia or generally agreed? What happened there?
Well, I pursue that a little bit in this book, but in earlier books, I did the Saltwater People books, the companion books. They won a Maritime History Prize, but I was doing the history of the coastline of the Sydney Basin. So one book was the northern side of the harbour and the other one was the south side.
Mm.
So I kind of looked in and I was really keen, you know, I studied Aboriginal mythology and a few other things at university and I was always interested in Aboriginal culture. So I was always, you know, like a lot of people, I didn't really know a lot about the coastal clans around Sydney and a lot of the information was kind of lost because they were the first clans to be impacted on when the, we call it an invasion, when the first fleet arrived. Because they, you know, Europeans arrived in numbers and basically smallpox and, you know, pressures that the population, the coastal clans were pretty well decimated within 2 years of the first fleet arriving.
Mm.
So no one was bothered to really keep the stories. But there are a few stories because especially on the south side, the Dharawal language group, they moved down the coast towards Eden and some of those stories are more intact than on the north side, the Darug people. But I got enough stories and enough information to understand that if you live along the coastline for, you know, 10,000 years, you're going to pick up a few skills. So they're gifted swimmers. Some of them would body surf using bits of wood and that kind of thing. You know, they used to go out, they'd be spotted out at sea, 2 miles out at sea in these little flimsy bark canoes with a little fire going in there, cooking the fish as they ate it. Sometimes with a baby in tow, a husband and wife with a baby in tow in these canoes. Wow. Are very proficient and sometimes coming in is actually an account near Fairy Bower of coming in canoes and riding the swells, not the breaking waves, but, you know, mm-hmm. getting a lift of the swells into the little beach there at Shelley Beach behind Fairy Bower. Well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's sort of, there were Aboriginal people, you wouldn't call them surfers, I guess, but they are water people. And what, you know, like in New Zealand, New Zealanders, you know, very proud of their Māori culture. And they and the skills that the Maori had as navigators and skilled water people, but we haven't really, you know, a lot of people when I said, oh, did you know the Aborigines surfed? They said, no, mate, they were scared of water. And that'd be true if you were a desert Aborigine living in the interior. But the coastal clans, you know, they weren't nomadic. That they moved totally out of the area. They're always in that kind of area, and they did have these skills. So. I acknowledge them as the first surfers in Australia. In terms of surf craft, it wasn't really till probably the turn of the century. It was only in the 1880s, 1890s, where Europeans started to become interested in the beach, but they'd be wading, you know, to roll up their skirts or pants and wade. It was probably not till late in the 1880s before people started to go in the water, and that was actually encouraged by a couple of South Sea Islanders like Tommy Tanner, which is a nickname, mm-hmm. Alec Wickham and his brother, who were great swimmers who introduced the Australian crawl over arm stroke.
Yeah.
So it's basically South Sea Islanders who sort of got things going there, showed us how to body surf, showed us how to swim properly, and then we quickly caught on. So there's a photograph, the earliest photograph of someone surfing is 1909, taken at Yamba I can't remember the chap's name, but he's doing a headstand. So that was like 4 or 5 years before Duke arrived, because everyone says Duke introduced surfing, which isn't quite true. There's actually a photograph of Duke walking up the beach after he's done his surf demonstration. Obviously, he would have been a lot better than any of the local people, and he had skills. He actually went past the whitewater and took off on an unbroken wave, which is probably unheard of. But in that photograph, there's probably at least seven other surf craft in that photograph, from hand planes and out the back, there's two people with surfboards out in the water behind in the background. So there was surf craft around before Duke arrived, but he's always gets credit. But
because of his, much because of who he was, I guess. Yeah.
Well, he was a champion, you know, he's an athlete. And I was talking about this the other day, I was in a conference with the Australian Historians Association, and when Duke arrived, it was Federation and pretty much the White Australia policy. And he basically broke down a lot of race barriers through. I mean, Australians tend to be colorblind when it comes to, you know, good athletes. And a lot of people can improve, like especially people from poorer regions and Indigenous people who have been oppressed can improve their status by being good sports people. Duke did it by being, he not only was a good sportsman, he was obviously Olympic gold medal swimming champion from the 1912 Stockholm Games, but he was also, a great surfer and a physically impressive person. Mm. But he also had the spirit of aloha, and he was very generous and a likable person. So, you know, he did a lot to sort of break down those race barriers that were existing around that time just after Federation.
Yeah, we can do with more Dukes, that's for sure. An important part in Australian history too, I guess, in that regard too. So what makes Australian surfing different, John, if it is different at all? Is it attachment to its past that you've just gone through? Or is it the culture of Australians in general, or the different breaks that we have? What makes it different?
It's complicated. In the early days, probably prior to the First World War, or prior to the first surf clubs, so they started up around 1908, the Australian classic figure was the bushy, so the solitary pursuit, and I like being out there by myself. You'll be out there and you'll see fish from around, maybe a dolphin, hopefully not a shark. Mm. And you're just out there with nature and seeing, as Tommy puts it, you paddle through a wave, you see the light come through the wave, and it's just, if it's an offshore day, it's just those magic little moments. And it also makes you fit, which helps the endorphins, it's exercise. So, it's all, yeah. I think for me, some places like probably hard to have a spiritual experience where you paddle out at Bondi on a crowded day, but where I surf down at Palm Beach and down near Barrenjoey, there's hardly anyone around there most of the time. When you look back at those early days when we took off from Adelaide in the 70s, a lot of those spots were pretty empty in those days, so I look back with them with nostalgia. So I guess and Stephen paddling out of Uluwatu for the first time, which he talks about in the book for Morning of the Earth in 71.
Yeah, beautiful.
No one knew this place. They had to find a way to get down off the cliffs and through a sea cave and then paddle out and look out these magnificent 300-foot or higher cliffs. And I said to him, "Would you feel you're scared?" He said, "No, I was just excited to get out there, like a 15-year-old just frothing to get out there." There's those moments. I think everyone has these moments. They just go, "Oh God, how good is this?" It might be the sunset surf or dawn surf or just a beautiful day where you've got some good waves.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. And you're aware of that, I think, from the time you start surfing. So that's wonderful. John, thanks so very much for being part of this and for being part of our summer edition too, which is appropriate with your book, Waterproof, which is out now, a collection of great Australian photography and some beautiful images in it. So as Molly Meldrum might have said, do yourself a favour and go out and get the book. It's a beautiful thing. So thanks, John.
Yeah, and if you can't find it in a bookshop, you can get them online through the cyclopsproductions.com.au website.
cyclopsproduction.com.au. Yeah. I saw that online. So just do that and you'll be rewarded with a beautiful book.